Fire is normally spelled with an I, unless someone's trying a little too hard to be cool, or it refers to the fire festival, the most amazing party in the world that never happened. Some of you may have heard about it or seen the documentaries. It was created by some event promoters, con artists, who used celebrities and models to advertise the most amazing two weekends of someone's life. It was to be held on a private island in the Bahamas. There were going to be musicians there that were internationally recognized. There were going to be models. There were going to be luxury villas. And there was going to be gourmet food and everything that you could possibly imagine to drink. It was supposed to be this amazing party. And people saw the advertisements, they heard about it, and it was spread on social media, and they paid thousands of dollars to go to this event. When they got there, they found out that instead of luxury villas, they were going to be staying in FEMA tents. Instead of being on a private island, it was basically a parking lot or an abandoned piece of land behind the Sandals Resort. Instead of having gourmet food, they were given pieces of white bread with Velveeta cheese and wilted lettuce on them. And instead of enjoying music all weekend, they were just going to end up trying to fight for one of the tents with wet mattresses that had been left out in the rain, and they were going to not get any of the entertainment. And then when they realized that none of the things that were promised to them were going to happen, and they tried to get home, they found themselves locked inside of an airport. It was an absolute disaster. None of the amazing promises that were made to them were fulfilled in the least bit. They were overpromised an amazing weekend and completely underdelivered or didn't deliver at all. And maybe you can relate to that experience in your life. Maybe you can relate to it in maybe certain professions that sometimes are known for making really big promises and not fulfilling those promises. And sometimes I wonder if I'm in one of those professions. If people come to the church and they hear these amazing promises about the kind of life and blessings you might get if you follow Jesus Christ, and then they feel like as they try to receive some of those promises or do the things that are suggested at the church, that those promises just don't seem to come true. I make up that that is what Abraham felt in this story that was read in Genesis 22, that God had made some really big promises to him. And by the end of the story, it feels like he's living in a tent and eating Velveeta cheese on white bread. I want to remind you of some of the promises that we have seen, particularly about the land that Abraham is going to own. So God has promised repeatedly in Genesis that he's going to give him the land of Canaan. Genesis 13, 15 through 17. All the land that you see, I will give it to you and your offspring forever. I will make your offspring like the dust of the earth so that if anyone could count the dust, then your offspring could be counted. Go walk through the length and breadth of the land, for I am giving it to you. And then in Genesis 17, he says, the whole land of Canaan, where you now reside as a foreigner, I will give you as an everlasting possession to you and your descendants after you, and I will be their God. God is very clear, or seems to be very clear, and definitely is very specific about the land that he is going to give to Abraham. He's telling Abraham that when he looks around the land of Canaan, all of that is going to belong to him, and all of it is going to belong to his descendants. But Abraham has lived in the land now for 62 years. He's 137 years old, and he continues to be a foreigner in the land. This is how he identifies himself when he talks to the people of the land, the Hittites, in Genesis chapter 23, verse 4. I am a sojourner and foreigner among you. Give you property among you, a burying place, that I may bury my dead out of my sight. Abraham has been wandering around. He's been living in tents, which in some ways, you know, we can glamorize that, but it also is another way of saying he's homeless for 62 years. And now he really needs land because his beloved wife, Sarah, who has been with him this entire time, has died, and he needs a place to bury her. The people of the land respond in verse 5. The Hittites answered Abraham, "Hear us, my lord. You are a prince of God among us. Bury your dead in the choicest of our tombs. None of us will withhold from you his tomb to hinder you from burying your dead." Abraham is a prince without a palace. He is a king without a country. And now he has to have a place to bury Sarah. But when he goes to the people of the land, the Hittites, they appear to be abundantly generous. As he approaches them, they honor him with this honorific title. They tell him, "You can take whatever you want. We will give you, there's not a single person among us who wouldn't give you this land." They appear to be abundantly generous, just like God. And it seems like God is going to fulfill all of his promises. But then it turns out that they're not actually generous. They're the worst kind of salesmen. They are making themselves appear generous. They're convincing Abraham that he can do business with them so that they can take from him as much as they can possibly think of. What they're doing is they are fooling Abraham into thinking, or at least they're using tactics, calculating all of their words and actions so that they can rob and take advantage of an elderly and grieving man. Abraham has a piece of land in mind. It is owned by a man named Ephron. We don't have any evidence that he is related to the Disney star Zac Efron, but there might be. We're not sure. But Abraham has seen a cave in his field. And there's something about that cave that he thinks that would be the perfect monument to my beautiful wife, Sarah. And so he wants the cave, and so he announces that to the group, and Ephron is sitting there. And instead of saying, "Yeah, you can have my cave," what he says to him is in verse 11, "No, my lord, hear me. I give you the field, and I give you the cave that is in it. In the sight of the sons of my people, I give it to you. Bury your dead." He's saying, look at what a generous guy I am. You don't just get the cave, you also get the field that it's in. But as I mentioned, he's actually calculating his words so that instead of being generous, he's actually planning on asking for as high of a price as possible. And Abraham doesn't just want it to be given to him. Abraham needs it to be sold and deeded over to him so that it will be a permanent possession for him. So then Ephron, after Abraham mentions this, saying, "I'm willing to pay whatever the price is," here's Ephron's clever answer. "My lord," verse 15, "listen to me. A piece of land worth 400 shekels of silver? What is that between you and me? Bury your dead." What a snake. He is saying that the price of the land in today's terms would be worth hundreds of millions of dollars. He is selling a field for what should have been the price of a city in those days' amounts. He is robbing Abraham blind. And so these people who appear to be so incredibly generous are actually taking full advantage of Abraham. And then we read in verse 16, Abraham listened to Ephron, and Abraham weighed out for Ephron the silver that he had named in the hearing of the Hittites, 400 shekels of silver, according to the weights current among the merchants. Abraham, God has given him a lot of wealth, and he takes a good portion of that wealth. He pays an arm and a leg for this field in the land of Canaan that God has promised in the entire land to him. And I wonder, there's one way of looking at this story, as not only has Abraham been ripped off by the Hittites, but it also feels like he's been ripped off by God. God has said, you're going to own all of this. I'm going to give it to you. And then it turns out that he has to pay a large chunk of all of his wealth for a tiny portion of it. Abraham goes to his fields and to his cave where he's going to bury his wife, and he looks out over all of the land that he does not yet own that God has promised to him. And I make up, if I were in that situation, that I would wonder what in the world God is doing. And I do know that I often feel that way, or have often felt that way throughout my life, and in many ways now, about God's extravagant promises to me. He hasn't promised me massive amounts of land, so you know I'm not concerned about the fact that I don't own land, and you know if I live another 100 years, you know there's still time. If he gives land at 137, so maybe it'll happen still at some point. But he hasn't promised me, you know, as many children as the stars of the sky. So two, that's great for me. It's not, I don't have expectations for that. But Jesus did promise that anyone who is weary and heavy laden could come to him and he would give them rest. I would say I am weary often. Heavy laden, I can relate to that. The rest part, it often feels like I could really use some fulfillment of that promise. That there are not, I could not always say in my life that I am experiencing the amazing rest that God has given to me. Jesus also promised that if anyone thirsts, that they could come to him, that he would give them water, and if they drank from it, they would never be thirsty again. In fact, they would have springs of living water flowing out of them. I can say that I thirst, not only physically, but also spiritually. I have come to Jesus to drink from that water, and it feels like I have thirsted again, that I could identify a lot better with the thirst part than this idea of springs of living water flowing out of me. God promised through the prophet Isaiah that if anyone hopes in the Lord, that they would renew their strength. They would mount up with wings like eagles. They would run and not grow weary. They would walk and not be faint. I have put my hope in the Lord, and yet I have run and I have grown weary. I have walked and I have been faint. God has made some very extravagant promises to me and to every person who believes in them. And yet when we look at the details of our lives, it feels like in many ways God has under-delivered on those promises. So what in the world is happening in Genesis chapter 23? What is God doing if he isn't the dishonest concert promoters like those in the Fire Fest? If he really is the faithful God throughout all generations, why is it that he promises Abraham all of the land of Canaan and then makes him pay an arm and a leg for a field. If we look at the story as Abraham, as a man of faith, we will understand that God can be trusted and that God's promises are being fulfilled enough for us to know that he is going to come through in everything that he has said. If we read the story looking at Abraham as a man of faith, the story is introduced in the end of chapter 22 by listing Abraham's brother and all of his descendants. And we get this report. We have been told earlier, I forgot about it, I'm sure you did too, but in chapter 11, we knew that Abraham had a brother, that he left there in Mesopotamia. And now we find out that his brother has been married. He's got two wives, and he's got 12 children, and he's got at least two grandchildren. One of them is named Rebecca. We're going to hear about her later. But the point is that Abraham gets this report about his brother, who wasn't called by God, didn't leave his homeland, and he's already got 12 children. And Abraham has two children, one of whom is living in Egypt. And so Abraham realizes that God is abundantly blessing his brother. And if I were Abraham, I would wonder, why isn't God blessing me? But I'm not Abraham. And Abraham has walked for 62 years with God, and he has come to the point in his life now, close to the end, where he trusts God enough that he is willing to accept whatever God gives him, knowing that God is going to fulfill his promises. And that is because God has given Abraham his special son, his beloved son Isaac, whom he loves with all of his heart. And even when God asks Abraham to give up his son Isaac, he trusted God enough. And when God gives him his son back, it's like he was raised from the dead. And Abraham has come to the point in his life where he knows that God is going to give him everything he needs, and even more than that. So even though he's got to fight for this land that God has promised him, even though he's got to deal with the shrewd people of the land, even though he has the option, I assume, of taking Sarah back to his homeland, he never once looks back. Instead, he perseveres in faith with these shrewd and dishonest people until ultimately they give him a permanent and public deed to the land. This is the end of the chapter, verse 17. So the field of Ephron in Machpelah, which was in the east of Mamre, the field with the cave that was in it, and all the trees that were in the field throughout its whole area. It's describing it geographically just like you would read on a deed that was in the public records, was made over to Abraham as a possession in the presence of the Hittites. They were the witnesses before all who went in and out of the gate of this city. And as kind of legal and sterile as that language sounds, that is a pretty profound verse there in the book of Genesis. Because this is the beginning of God's fulfillment of his promise to Abraham and his descendants to own the land. As small as the piece of land is, as difficult as it was to get it, this is evidence that God is going to keep his promises, that God is going to be faithful to all that he has promised to Abraham and to all of his descendants. This is the interpretation as Abraham, as a man of persevering faith, that the author of Hebrews gives us in Hebrews chapter 11. He says, "These all died in faith, not having received the things promised, but having seen them and greeted them from afar, and having acknowledged that they were strangers and exiles on the earth." That was the language that Abraham used. "For people who speak thus make it clear that they are seeking a homeland. If they had been thinking of that land from which they had gone out, they would have had opportunity to return. Abraham could have gone back to Mesopotamia, back to the city of Ur, back to his family, but instead, as it is, they desire a better country, that is, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared for them a city. When Abraham stood on that piece of land and looked at that cave that he had purchased, he did not for one second think that God had frauded him or ripped him off or stolen from him or disappointed him in any way. He saw it as the beginning of the fulfillment of God's abundant promises to him. In the same way, as God takes us along our journey of faith, as we see God's fulfillment of his promises in our lives, even in really small, even in really slow ways, even when we have to persevere in faith, when it feels incredibly painful and exhausting, we see each fulfillment of God's promise as a sign that there is more yet to come. We know that his promises are only partially going to be fulfilled in this life. But we hang on in faith because God has given us enough to believe that it is worth it to believe in him, because someday all of his promises are going to be fulfilled. Someday we will be perfectly at rest in him. So whatever rest we get in this life is a reminder to us of God's faithfulness. Someday we will be perfectly fulfilled. Those streams of living water will be constantly flowing out of us. We will be so refreshed in every single moment that we wouldn't think for a second of turning away from God. So whatever refreshment and whatever fulfillment we get in this life, they're a sign that God is going to keep his promises. Whatever strength we experience in our trouble, whenever moments we have where we realize that we could never endure this apart from God, that God is doing enough for us to get us through, we trust that that is the beginning of God's fulfillment of his promises. And like Abraham, we have been given a special son, someone who is a gift from God, who is a reminder to us of God's amazing grace. And if that was the only thing that God gave to us, was his one and only son, Jesus Christ, to die on the cross for us, then we would say that is enough. That is enough for us to trust God. If he has given us Jesus, then we know that there is going to be a day when along with him, he gives us everything else. But God doesn't just give us Jesus. Along the way, he continues to give us reminders of his abundant grace and of his amazing faithfulness to us. So we persevere in faith, realizing that God's promises are only partially being fulfilled in this life. We wait for the next, for him to completely fulfill all of his promises to us. The comedian Michael Jr. talks about how that when he was a kid and he went to church and there was a coffin in the front, he was a little afraid because no one told him there was going to be a coffin in the front of the church on that particular day. He thought it was just a regular worship service that every once in a while they put someone in a coffin in the front of the church just to show you that they mean business or something like that. And so he asked his grandmother about it, and his grandmother says he went to see the king. And then the kids get up, and he's in the children's choir, and they sing, soon and very soon, we're going to see the king. And he wonders what this man did to the king that made him end up in the box in the front of the church. And then he goes back to his grandmother, and his grandmother gives him more explanation. She says to him, he's in a better place. And he thinks, what kind of box was he in before? What was it? Smaller? Was it more cramped? Was it something like that? But that was all that he had, and obviously, as a comedian, he's making a lot of that stuff up. But the reality is that that's about what all of us can expect. Perhaps a coffin, perhaps 6 feet of land somewhere where we will permanently reside. Perhaps we will be placed in an urn at some point. And it would be possible to look at that and say, I trusted God. I persevered in faith. And in the end, my life does not look all that much different from those who don't trust God, those who are just living for themselves and ignoring God in all of their lives. But if you're a Christian, you believe that God has given you Jesus Christ, and we look at that in faith, it changes the entire perspective. When we go to a Christian burial service, I say we are here as a testimony of our faith in the resurrection, believing that the same God who created our bodies and breathed life into them will one day speak out and raise us from the dead, that though we are from dust and to dust we shall return, someday we will be raised up and reunited with God, and all of his promises will at that point be completely fulfilled to us. We continue in this life to persevere in faith because we believe that God's promises are partially, sometimes slowly, sometimes in very small ways, but they are being fulfilled. And someday we will get to experience all that God has promised to us. This is what we believe, and God is faithful. Amen.